I don't have a fashion background. Natalia doesn't have a fashion background either. We don't have a business background either. This is why like 99% of the decisions that we have been taking and that are still taking are really based on intuition and what feels right.
Das ist der Telekom Electronic Beats Podcast, der Podcast rund um Nachtleben und Clubkultur.
Wir sprechen mit DJs, Türstehern, Tänzern, Clubbetreibern und anderen Nachtmenschen.
Mein Name ist Gesine Kühne.
Und ich bin Jakob Töne.
Herzlich willkommen beim Electronic Beats Podcast. Welcome to the Telekom Electronic Beats Podcast. I am Gesine Kühne. Hope you're all doing well. In today's episode, we take a look at fashion. Fashion always has been, always will be a close friend to music. As you look at different music styles, for example, they all have their distinct look. My interview partner today is Thomas Wierski of Misbehave, a Polish brand with quite a success story, which is almost like a fairy tale. It wouldn't be the Telekom Electronic Beats Podcast if there wasn't some electronic music involved as well. I hope you enjoyed this episode because I certainly had so much fun talking to Thomas of Misbehave. Thomas Wierski, is that the way you'd pronounce your name?
Exactly.
Well, welcome to the Electronic Beats Podcast.
Thank you.
Nice to see you. We're meeting via Zoom. And where do I reach you now? Where are you at?
I'm in the south of Poland in Krakow today.
Is that where you're from, or?
I was born in Sweden. My parents were Polish, and they have immigrated up north, and they've lived there for 20 years. And I've been back in Poland from the age of 7, and I've been going back and forth between Warsaw and Krakow. I'm in Krakow today. I'm going to Gdańsk later. Yeah.
Okay, so you have a busy life, not only doing the work, what we're going to talk about, but also just like, also, let's say, a busy or interesting family background, because it's a very interesting combination, born in Sweden, back to Poland, you know. Is that something you cherish? I mean, that you have this background?
It's not an obvious one. You know, I think the Swedes and Poles are very, very different in the way that they're brought up and in the way that they live. And I have to say my relationship to both Sweden and Poland is really changing in time. Not sure where I am at this point, actually, because what was happening in Poland in the last few years politically has not been easy, to say the least. But, you know, also I'm kind of happy that we have this brand and this platform that can also, from time to time, take a bit of stance on that and also share how we feel about this. But yeah, definitely this relationship to where you're from, who you are, is changing every day. But this is, I think this is the nature of life, actually.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, you said you have this brand and platform. I didn't introduce you properly. You're Thomas Wierski of, I would say, Misbehave, right? Is that the way we pronounce it?
Yeah, we have an agreement on that.
It's a street and club wear fashion label. Price-wise, I would rather see it in high fashion than street fashion. And also a record label now. So I would love to know pretty much everything you can tell me. Are you ready?
Always.
Okay, well, let's get into it. You are, as you just said, you're born in Sweden and you're from Poland. I think you started the label around 2014. Is that correct?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, with your creative partner, Natalia Maciek. Maciek, is that the way you pronounce that name? See, I'm going to ask those questions all the time.
You're very good in this pronunciation business.
Okay, whoa, poof. So amazing. You two met in Poland?
Yeah. We actually met when we were kids, when we were 16, I think. And we've remained best friends ever since. And although, you know, our roads have been kind of parting and then going back together throughout the years. Yeah, we've been building this brand together and it became a way of life for us, and especially in the last 5-6 years, I would say.
Yeah, I did a lot of reading research on the label because I have to admit, although I would probably consider myself a club kid myself, I was not completely aware of your story. Definitely saw the name before in a couple of pieces because there's always, you know, certain labels like GmbH. Yeah, GmbH, you know what I mean. You know, certain labels that push to the front and people say, oh, this is the new clubbing shit. And I always take myself back a bit and say, well, isn't club wear something that people just wear to the club? Does there have to be a label to be labeled club wear? What do you say to that?
Well, I think it's an inspiration. I think it's almost like an artistic idea. I think club is a catalyst for so many emotions and experiences that really shape us and build us. And I think this is a very serious foundation for something much more than just a club. For me, it's a feeling. It's a sense of belonging. It's a sense of freedom. It's a bit of hedonism too, as well, of course. It's this whole catalyst of emotions that you can translate into whatever you want, into film, into photography, into fashion. So yeah, that's how I see it.
When you started, what was the intention behind it?
Well, we started it, well, firstly in Poland, that doesn't really have a fashion culture, that doesn't really have fashion schools, that didn't really have any fashion business or stores at the time. There was no support system for young designers or young brands. So, you know, being from Poland, you kind of don't think of this as a serious, you know, undertaking. So it was purely, and still is purely, a passion thing, you know, making pieces that we want to wear that we wouldn't really find anywhere else. It was making stuff that we want to do and avoiding stuff that we don't want to do.
In an interview I read that you guys talked about Poland right after 1989. The wall came down in Germany. The Cold War was over. Like, there was always, I mean, okay, if you're a bit younger and you're not firm on Cold War and all the change that happened to Germany and the Eastern European bloc, I would say, please read up on it because it's a very interesting story, very interesting history, what has been happening over all those years until that time. And the coming down of the wall, it definitely has affected Eastern Europe. You were a kid. What do you remember from that time?
I mean, 1989 and pre-89 is my parents' time, really. It's my parents' era. But I think actually you can trace some of our DNA to pre-89 as well, because, you know, obviously time is linear and all these things are combined and make one oneness in the end. So pre-89, you know, it was the time of communism, incredible time of hardships, you know, grotesque censorship, you know, flexing military muscle on people. And I think this is some of the DIY ethos is really coming from, because for our parents, if they saw, you know, a gray jacket on the cover of a magazine, it's not like in France where you could just go and buy it. You would have to make it yourself. And I think this is a foundation for great creativity and the DIY culture or philosophy that I talked about. Also, you know, as we know from history, the times of hardships are usually a very fertile ground for art and expression, and some of the best music and film coming from Poland actually, you know, was born in the 60s, the jazz scene, the films, you know, 60s was a great decade all across the board, actually, in Europe and in the States. And it must have been a reaction to the war, I suppose. But yeah, Poland before 1989 was very closed off. like all the other Eastern European countries. And then 1989 comes and suddenly the gates are open and the West floods in. And obviously, at first, we're super excited, and the East falls in love with the West immediately. You know, the iconography of brands like McDonald's, Coca-Cola. It's something that people really, really cherish, because this is something that they were longing for such a long time. But as far as I remember, in terms of fashion, companies like Zara or H&M, they didn't really penetrate the market until like 2001, 2002. And before that, it was the thrift, the secondhand store, that really was where you would go to find pieces that you want to wear. And I was just thinking about it today before this, how when we were first trying to make collections, we were always like very hard on ourselves, because nothing really matched together, and everything felt so messy, and one piece wouldn't really work with the other, and it was just terrible. But from a few years perspective, I think this really was the effect of the secondhand store, of the thrift store, because you have to tell the difference between a secondhand store and a vintage store. A vintage store is nice and curated, and all these pieces kind of make sense together. And in the secondhand store, obviously this is not the case. So you have a Hawaiian shirt sitting next to a tracksuit, next to fancy loafers. And I think this is where some of it was really coming from. This is how we thought about piecing a collection together. And then early 2000s were really my childhood memories, and this mixing of technicality, of the Western branding, of perhaps finding some of our Eastern identity again. The early 2000s were a very interesting time. Pre-internet, a time that I see as a sort of a no man's land, where I think we really didn't want to be East Europe anymore, and we wanted to embrace the West, but we definitely weren't West either. Mm-hmm. So I think a very, very, you know, interesting time sociologically and historically.
So in the 90s, you didn't have any so-called fashion at all. It was like secondhand or vintage, piecing things together, influenced by the West. Probably still this attitude of finding stuff or making things work from the East, that you have been seen in Western magazines, maybe. Because, I mean, we have to talk money as well. Being the Eastern European bloc, I mean, there was nothing in income comparable to the West. So that must have been also a hard time, because probably prices rising, you know, the Western influence in capitalism coming in, but not in getting the same money. That's a huge issue, isn't it? Or wasn't it?
Oh, it definitely still is. Mm. Definitely still is.
Okay. You already said your fashion approach was like piecing things together or getting to the point where like, this doesn't really match. Do you have any fashion background, or was it just pure interest?
No. We have no fashion background, because like I said, growing up in Poland, this is not something that you take seriously, because you don't have magazines, you don't have designers, you don't have these success stories that you can follow. And for us personally, it's always been somewhat of a personal goal to really change it. Yeah. I'm not saying that we're incredibly successful or anything like that, but there was really no brand before us that would, you know, get to certain stores or make it to certain magazines. And it was always our intention to kind of become this platform for these kids today that can have something that we perhaps didn't really have. But no, I don't have a fashion background. Natalia doesn't have a fashion background either. We don't have a business background either. And this is why, like 99% of the decisions that we have been taking and that are still taking are really based on intuition and what feels right.
Just to give a bit of background, I mean, Natalia isn't there with you now, but she went to London at one stage and was very inspired by, let's say, the whole lifestyle. You know, there is a certain feel about London, and especially back in the days, even more so than now, where it seems very mainstreamed, even the places that were so inspiring, like Camden Market and so on. And then she came back, and you also were inspired by club life, or as I read, you were club kids. Maybe you still are club kids. And you printed T-shirts.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, going to London was an eye-opener because, yeah, you're obviously the way that people lived and how the music sounded and this mixture of cultures and this also like sexual openness was something that we didn't really know. And we also went there at the time when we were like 17. So it was actually a very like profound time to be exposed to something so radically different and open and beautiful. And coming back to Poland, this is something that we wanted to create for our friends as well. So yeah, it started from like everyone, you know, we were kids, we didn't really have any money. There was this like punk printing shop that would make these t-shirts for very little, and that's how the brand has started, you know. On one hand, printing mm-hmm. t-shirts for friends, on the other hand, still reworking, you know, bits from these secondhand stores. And then the parties came and events came and you know, trying to piece a community around these positive values. And I think with every little thing that we did, a bit more of a community was building of kids that were kind of centered around these really positives, around this positive message that we were trying to convey of openness, of you know, being together. And this definitely was inspired by the UK and London and traveling in a broader sense.
Mm. You just mentioned like a punk print shop and so on. When I read your story, of course, I had an instant thought, which is Vivian Westwood. You know, that's how she started, beginning of the 70s. It was all about coming together and just doing what she wants to do. And it was a punk crowd supporting her stuff. And then it grew into this huge fashion brand. The story is, of course, a bit more detailed, but just my initial thought was like, hey, that happened before, which is a nice way of happening, because it's so self-made and not so business driven as a lot of things these days. Was that already part, was that back in your head, or weren't you aware of Vivian back in the time?
We were aware of her and Malcolm McLaren and people like that, but I mean, you would never ever compare or think of yourself in this perspective, because again, this was never supposed to be anything serious. So this okay. comparison was never on the table, to be honest.
Okay, you were pretty ballsy, I would say. You just went to Paris and opened a showroom in 2015. I mean, 2015 is just 6 years ago, and if we just think back 6 years ago, we've already been this fast fashion world where people try to make it but constantly fail because they're not there in the right time with the right money, especially. But you just went and opened the showroom. How was that possible?
Yeah, this is the beauty of being young and really not realizing what you're going in for. yeah, it's 2015 and our friend Luca from Paris helped us finding a space that would suit our budget. And our budget was 200 euros a day, which in Paris gives you a hole in the wall. I remember it was January 2015, really cold winter. Mm. And we got this shitty gallery, 25 square meters in Passage du Gravier in the Third, where most of the brands show. A space with no heating, really damp. Yeah, and we just planted ourselves there, the three of us on the floor for, I would say, 5 weeks, waiting for people to miraculously just come in and make orders. And we had no idea how to go about this. We made maybe 10 pieces and we thought this is probably an interesting collection. It was like one wool coat, one sweater, and a bunch of like smaller pieces. We were equipped with free posters that we put on the wall, I remember. And I also remember that we didn't have this like the sticker that you're supposed on your front door, and we printed it in Paris, and I remember printing it was actually more expensive than coming to Paris from Poland. And we're sitting there just waiting for something to happen. And one day a very, you know, beautiful, super elegant lady comes into to the gallery, and she's clearly there by mistake. But she's looking at these posters, and she's looking at these pieces, and she's listening to the music, and we start talking, and we had a very, very nice conversations about where we're from, about what this collection was inspired by, and it was, you know, about Kraftwerk and Brian Eno, and we had this t-shirt that said Warszawa. She really liked it, and it was one of the pieces that was quite successful at the time. And we spoke about how this is a reference to Brian Eno and Bowie and also Joy Division. And she looked at it all and she's like, you know, this is quite interesting. Let me come back the next day. And the next day she returns with two more guys, equally elegant. And these guys, like, they really felt like they know what they're talking about. And they turned out to be buyers from Louis, which is this landmark in Antwerp. We later learned that she was the first to buy Margiela. And she trusted us. And she bought a brand that didn't even have a business card or didn't have a catalog. We just had an Instagram account and an amazing store in Antwerp that was, you know, home to so many incredible designers. And the same season, Browns bought us, GR8, Antonioli. And yeah, we knew nothing about fashion at the time, but by luck and coincidence and I don't know what, we had four of the best retailers in the world. And this is how it started for us.
Yeah, it's such a fairy tale story. You know, I'm actually getting goosebumps. I'm like, I don't know what it was, but universe was just like, those guys, they're in for it now. That is, yeah, stuff like that still happens, definitely. And I'm so happy about it too, that a couple people, even though they are in such a different, for me, universe, just like money-wise or fashion-wise, you know, that they are still so open to what fashion is actually about, which is an expression of all kinds of feelings. You know, it's important. It's an art. It's an art form, just like music. And an art form just projects the time we live in. So, yeah. So it's like you know. It's I'm almost speechless because that's such a great story. I love it. So yeah, all of the sudden, there were luxury fashion buyers and you had this very punk approach towards fashion. Was there fear creeping up your neck?
Yeah, it's a nice add-on probably to have these stores, but also we didn't really realize the challenges that it would bring. Because to me, the biggest challenge that I saw at the time was, how do you make a collection a year in advance? How do you know what you're going to feel a year in advance? Because this has to be sincere and it has to be honest, right? And it has to be, like you said, in conversation with with reality and with the time, how can you predict a year from now what this honesty will be? And then came more challenges, like how do you actually physically make a collection so far in advance? How do you make a collection that is not 10 pieces? How do you make a collection that will have a certain level of expertise in the way that it's made, in the fabric that it's using, in the deadlines that it has to be delivered at? Because for us, we were coming from the world of this intuition and really how streetwear operates. And streetwear is very, very immediate, very quick, very fast. It reacts to reality in a very, very fast manner. So, you know, I always say, like, you think of a piece on Monday, you design it on Tuesday, you print it on Wednesday, you sell it on Thursday, and by Friday night, you see it in a club being, you know, physically worn. You see it in this physical world. And the time is very, very fast. The turnaround is super, super fast. Mm-hmm. And suddenly, this modus operandi has to change. And suddenly you're entering a whole new game, not just on the level of logistics. And believe me, like, we've been struggling with it ever since, and we're still struggling with it today, simply because you're kind of made to work on a timeline of a Gucci or a Prada. But you're still a very small independent brand, yet the rules are the same for everyone. So this doesn't really play in favor of smaller brands, but, you know, you have no choice, and you have to improve and constantly fight to get it right. But also in terms of, like, creation, it is changing. And at first I was very scared of this, because, again, how can you make something honest when you're used to this reactive mode in such a time advance? But this actually is an incredibly fulfilling experience, because it makes you actually not look at the world and react to the world. It makes you look inwards, and it makes you ask questions to yourself. And these questions are always, always relevant. So the difference to me, the biggest difference between fashion and streetwear is actually this inward looking practice that is much more deep, much more abstract. And at first I didn't understand it at all. And I remember I was reading this quote about, who was it? Rei Kawakubo, I think, when she was briefing her team at Comme des Garçons. So they have this preseason meeting where she's supposed to give them this great vision about how the collection will be, and all this team is gathered in there. And she walks in and she's very, very quiet, and she sits on the stool and she says, "Rain." And this is where the collection then is supposed to be born from. And yeah, 5 years ago I didn't understand, but now actually I understand a little bit more. And it's very fulfilling and much more interesting, actually, to work this way.
How was that received within your inner cycle, within your friend cycle, the early adopters, I would say, that had your pieces before?
I mean, they were always very, very supportive, I have to say. And we always felt like we have people's back. And also, like I said, we had this ambition to also make something more of this brand than just, you know, a collection of cool pieces that you wear. We always wanted this to become a platform for young creatives and for kids back home. And this is something that we slowly try to build. You know, whenever we can, we try to give back to our community as well. So, you know, from making masks for our local hospitals when the pandemic began, to, you know, teaming up with Souvenir from Berlin and making a pro EU rave before the last European elections, because we saw that anticipated level of participation from kids in Poland wasn't really as high as we wished. So we thought, why don't we make a rave with team up with Souvenir and try to educate kids a little bit about the importance of these elections. Like I said, you know, events and giving back to the community in all these different ways. So obviously, you know, everything changes with time, but I have to say people have been very supportive and we've been quite well perceived. And as soon as we can get out there in the physical world, we want to also engage with the world in a more tangible physical way again. This is something that I'm really looking forward to.
I just want to talk quickly about the design, because you mentioned a couple cool pieces back in the days you screen printed. What did they look like?
Well, they were much more simple than what we were doing today. Some of the pieces that I remember that gave me a lot of satisfaction were, you know, patchwork denim that we would source in these secondhand stores. It was printing on leather. We were quite bold actually in the variety of pieces that we were making, also swimwear and you know, a lot of pieces not realizing at first how difficult actually it is to make them. But again, this is I guess the naive nature of being very young. But also I think this attitude that we also need in the world in general. Mm-hmm.
And if I look at your designs now, I see lots of 90s references with all the tribals, some neon colors. It's very techy, I would say, techy wear. What do the 90s mean to you?
Oh, man. I mean, I was, to me, like, you know, Jürgen Teller, Corinne Day, films like Kids, music like, you know, the Wu-Tang. This was my education, and I think it's crazy how today these things are still so relevant. But I think the relevance of the 90s has a lot to do with its grit, with its rawness, with its poetic rawness, actually, with the dirt. It feels very immediate. It feels like something that you can almost like touch and feel. And I think this is what is such an inspiration for us. I think as humans, we're drawn to imperfections. You know, listening to a record from the 90s on vinyl gives you a much different feeling that obviously listening to a Spotify playlist today, with music that is so polished and so perfect, it doesn't somehow feel right. And as humans, we're drawn to these imperfections. Imperfections is a natural state. It's something that we're drawn to. It's something that is very, very human. I read somewhere that imperfection is infinite, is divine, and there's something to it. And I think the 90s, you know, were super, super cool. In that, you know, so many icons were born, and looking at the Kate Moss picture taken by Jürgen will always give you goosebumps, and it will always feel so, so cool. So I think on all of these levels, I think is why the 90s are so prevalent and so important for me personally, but also for this generation.
Mm. By Jürgen, you mean Jürgen Teller, right?
Yeah.
Yes, I just want to make that little acknowledgement for people that are not into photography, or Jürgen Teller, who is a German photographer who is quite famous, I would say. And if you ever get a chance to see an exhibition, do so, because it's very interesting. It doesn't have to be beautiful all the time, but it's definitely very interesting.
So inspiring, and even today, knowing... Honestly, like, I have a whole hard drive with all the images that I've collected of him through the years, because I've always been always been a fan of him, of his. And I was recently, it's incredible how stuff that he puts out in 2020 is as good as stuff that he would do in the 90s. It's still groundbreaking. It's still challenging you. It's still so good.
Back to your design. You also have like long leather coats, and I always think of The Matrix, of course. I think everyone would do so. Is that still club wear, or is it a high fashion thing with club appeal, or does that go together?
I don't really like labeling it. For me, high fashion doesn't have a nice ring to it. For me, it sounds kind of exclusive. And again,
well, your prices are a bit exclusive.
I would disagree.
Okay. Well, let's agree to disagree here.
Yeah, like there's always a little bit of discussion, like, are these prices right? Are these too high? Are these too low? I think we've always had an ambition to make quality stuff. And we've been kids from Eastern Europe that were, you know, inspired by also, you know, Comme des Garçons and this sort of thing that is a little bit more expensive, but it also gives you a lot more for this price. And the reality of things in 2021 is if you want to produce in Europe, if you want to use the best fabrics possible sourced in Italy and Portugal, if you want to pay people well, if you want to you know, give people, you know, certain contracts and actually provide them with a, you know, with an experience that is also cool for them. You know, if you want to use packaging that is recyclable, if you want to use recycled fabrics as well, all of this comes at a certain price and is just unavoidable. And I think for the quality that we provide, we could be much more expensive. And could we be cheaper? We couldn't, because were we cheaper, we would compromise on quality. And this is something that we never want to make. We want these pieces to last you forever. We came up with this idea of a future vintage and how we want to find our pieces that we make today in the best vintage stores in 20 years. And in order to do that, not only design has to be special, but they also need to stand the test of time. And if you cut corners on quality, this won't happen.
You just changed my mind, of course, and it's actually just a matter of us, I guess, educating without the, you know, lifting the finger. We need to educate younger fashion people. We need to educate them in slow fashion and sustainability and it's the circle of fashion. And we need to lower fast fashion. I mean, I get caught up in fast fashion all the time again and again. But if we get a bit more awareness out, I think maybe we're slowly able to change things. And we need to, because as we know, the fashion industry is the second biggest polluter in the world.
Yeah, but I'm very positive, actually, seeing how the industry is changing, seeing how we choose stuff differently today as opposed to 10 years ago. I mean, go to any restaurants. There are hardly any restaurants that don't really offer, you know, bio-organic options right now. Think about buying a car and look at the car market in America and see how Tesla is valued higher than all of its competitors put together. The air has changed and the fashion is changing very, very fast as well. Going to a trade show where you buy fabrics today is a completely different experience than even 5 years ago. Like, the way that it's changed is so rapid and so good.
It's going to be a little bit of a topic jump, because I want to get back to your design, to what I find a very, very, very important design topic or idea is gender interchangeability. It is very important to you. Why is that so?
Oh, well, this is where we came from. You know, this is how we started. And this was a natural state, I would say, for us to kind of not be restrained by gender. And actually, for us, getting into more of a gender-specific fashion, this actually was inspiring and interesting throughout these past few years, simply because our starting point was unisex and interchangeability. And in the last few years, we found it more interesting to actually trying to make fashion in a more traditional way. There are certain pieces in which making gender-specific fashion is unavoidable, just for the simple fact of the matter that we are built a little differently. But then also it's super interesting to be focusing on areas where we can actually wear the same pieces, and you know, it's this also is changing so fast, and for instance with our sport line, I can see so many guys wearing it and also actually getting the women's pieces because they want the fit to be even tighter, even more close to the body. And this exchange with the world is also very inspiring to us as designers. But I think the bottom line is, no matter if you work on interchangeability or if you work in a more traditional way, the most important actually is for all of these pieces to come from one singular point of view. And then, you know, translating it into these different pieces, it comes secondary.
So let's talk music then. Let's talk, we finish with the fashion talk here. Let's go into music, which is also one of my favorite topics. you founded a label, Misbehave Recordings. Why?
Because we think I think if you have a certain point of view, there are unlimited means to express this point of view. And what we touched on at the very beginning of this conversation, when we talked about what club actually is and it being a catalyst for so many different meanings and emotions, music and a label is another very interesting avenue to explore it. We're not founding this label to compete with other labels or to put out music that is going to be in the Beatport 100. We want to express ourselves through friends. That's why the first EP that we've put out last year was Wolfram and Hell, who have been good friends, and there's nothing, you know, nicer than collaborating with friends on projects that you believe in. Our second EP, we are just putting out actually last week, and it is For a Change, a meditation record. We started thinking about, okay, what should be the next record right when the pandemic started, and it didn't feel right to, you know, to be conceiving a club record at the time for a number of reasons. The one being, you know, seeing images of Northern Italy at the beginning of the pandemic, and how army would be, you know,
they were transporting the coffins to a different city or town because they couldn't handle all those deaths in Bergamo anymore. It's funny that you bring up this picture because I was just listening to the podcast yesterday, which is about fake news and conspiracy theories, because we have one huge conspiracy person here in Germany who used to be a famous radio host, and the podcast is around him and just how we fall for conspiracy theories, and they're exactly describing this the same the same picture you just started, which is a bit strange, but I totally feel it, and I understand your approach to coming out with a meditation record, just to sit down and reflect on ourselves and what has happened the last 1.5 years and what has it done to us actually and to our minds.
Yeah, I think in each country we have a fair share of these guys that you described. But yeah, so it's this image on one hand, then it's, you know, all the small businesses that have been closing down, and your friend who has a corner cafe might not even be there the next day. But then also the positives, you know, the fact that we have all slowed down, and then the images of also nature rebirthing and rejuvenating and metamorphing into a better state with just a few months of the industry actually backing down. And all of this inspired this idea of, why don't we look at meditation at this inwards looking perspective from the perspective of electronic music, if you will, and we also thought, why don't we look at it from a more geographical experience? Because something that is so incredibly inspiring to me about this experience is that this is for my generation, for our generation across the world, until we die, this will be the one experience that for sure we will share together. No matter where you are in the world, no matter the age, if you were alive in 2020, you will have the same experience that I have, and this will be something that we will actually always share together. So I also see this album as a witness to something incredible that, you know, perhaps will gain value with time, because today it's meditation, it's interesting meditation music today, but in 10 years from now it will be a witness to something really, really incredible, you know. And I think of it as you know, sometimes you have these, for example, in photography, this happens quite often when you have a teenage photographer that is an amateur that is just shooting pictures of his friends for like 20 years, and technically he might suck and it might not be, you know, very elaborate work, but with time it actually gains some significance. So this is how I look at this record.
Yeah, you said earlier that you're building like a platform and music. I think the music recording or the music label is just part of it. In my notes, I wrote down that you have very prominent friends, and they're also like releasing mixes and so on via Misbehaved Recordings on SoundCloud. And my initial idea was, what about using that reach for young talents in the music industry, for example? Are you going to do that, or are you already doing it?
Yeah. I mean, we're just really learning the ropes, you know, with the, like, we have no experience of releasing music before that, just as we didn't have any experience with fashion before starting Misbehaved. So the first record is, how many vinyls do you cut? How do you distribute this thing? How do you get people to hear it? How do you get stores to buy it? So we're just learning. It's just our second project. I believe we have many, many more in the pipeline. I think what you're touching on is really, really important. If you have, you know, we're working at this record right now where we have two legends, really two legends who are working for the first time together for Misbehaved Recordings. And, you know, if we get these two legends together, it's 1 + 1, it's perhaps equals 3 or 4. But what if we juxtapose it actually with young talent coming from a completely different background who would look at these guys in the way that we perhaps looked at this fashion when we started, like without no constraints, like just some two guys releasing music. And now I wanna, you know, make an interpretation of their work that will completely destroy their work in a positive way. And then 1 + 1 perhaps equals 5 or 6 or 7. So this is very, very important for us. And yeah, it's within our DNA and something that we definitely want to convey with Misbehaved Recordings as well.
What you just described reminded me of Margiela, just like the deconstruction of fashion and then rearranging it completely in a new way. It works for music as much as it works for fashion. I saw on your label SoundCloud that you personally, you, Thomas Wierski, have been musically active. How important is DJ or producing work for you?
I have been musically active. That's true. Actually, before Misbehave, I was working in music, and I was a producer myself. And this is where I come from. And I think through a certain freedom that I have learned through music, also the way that I'm looking at fashion and style and what we do with Misbehave has been also altered in this more, you know, free spirited way, perhaps. I love DJing still. It gives me immense pleasure to do it, and it gives me a platform to really express myself, and I really, really, really love it. It is my first love, actually. You know, fashion and clothing and what we do with Misbehave actually came later. And for Meditations, for our second EP, I really wanted to work with Zuzanna Bartoszek, who was my favorite Polish painter and a great Polish poet who I really, really admire. And I made a sort of an industrial meditation with Zuzanna, speaking on the record using one of her guided meditations, and I'm very happy with the record, and I'm happy it's a part of this album.
Since we already, of course, we have to talk, it's part of our lives, as you said, the pandemic as such a strong thing to get us through the last 1.5 years in many directions, mentally, work-wise, for so many people, it meant financial hell. We also, music-wise, for example, I thought maybe it would change the DJ business a bit, you know, slowing it down, not having two European DJs flying over to North or South America twice on one weekend. You know what I mean? You know, it's just like... it seemed like nature is healing in a really good way, but now it seems like everything is back to normal business. What was the fashion industry like? There were fashion weeks missed, probably, then digital fashion weeks. What did that whole thing all did to you, except putting out a meditation record? What else?
I mean, you know, we react to the world around us, and when such an earthquake happens, it changes the way that you look at everything. So you touched on missing the fashion shows and fashion week. I think this was actually very good for smaller brands, because something that smaller independent brands need to kind of fight against is the immense media power that the huge brands have. And for them, you know, a fashion show is such an investment and such a, you know, such muscle flexing with again, the DJ might be flying to North America from Europe, but then imagine staging a show in Brazil and having 500 influencers being flown from all across the world for a 10-minute show. So compare this. But when these shows didn't happen, actually it was a positive for the smaller brands, because suddenly we could compete equally. What it meant for us was, you know, of course at first a great deal of uncertainty, but then finding peace and finding ease in actually, you know, bunkering up in the studio and working with your two hands very physically in a much more focused manner. So this brought a sense of ease for us, for sure. And then, you know, we touched upon nature healing itself, and it gave us a lot of hope, actually, to kind of ramp up our sustainability efforts. So during the pandemic, we actually had time to to focus on the recyclable packaging made of post-consumer waste and these eco bags made of some of the bottles found in oceans. So this was another angle for us. And actually, the collection that we have just finished came out of this experience as well. We're deep in the pandemic, February this year, when we started working on it. I was fortunate to be able to go to Mexico for a couple of weeks. And I remember one of the first days, you know, after being in the beach, in the sun, in the ocean for a couple of days, I'm waking up super, super early. And I had these two distinctive thoughts in my head. One is orange and one is green. And at first I didn't know what it means. And I took my phone and I started writing a note describing how I feel. And it sounds completely ridiculous, but what I wrote actually, it's orange because we're all children of the sun, and it's green because we're all children of the earth. And at first it sounded completely, completely crazy, but what it meant and what this trip meant for me was coming back to this place of honesty within myself and rediscovering who I really was after months of being confined to a white room. And this laid the foundation for the work on a new collection. So I've sent this little note to my friends back home, and a week later mood boards came in. And it's incredible how within our team we have a few designers, and each of them interpreted these words in the exact same way. And it's the first time in the history of Misbehave that the collection was actually so cohesive and felt so precise, even though it really came out of these two words, orange and green, which reminds me of the Rei Kawakubo story that I told mm-hmm. That I told before. And every collection is blood, sweat, and tears, and we're fighting super, super hard to get it right. And then we usually take a few days off, and usually a few days in of the vacation, someone writes an email and says something like orange and green, and everything starts again.
Well, I'm actually quite happy with what you told me in the last hour.
It was a nice conversation.
I would say, you know, let's finish here. I had such a great time talking to you, having a little sneak peek into your head, which I really, really enjoyed. Mm. Thanks for your time. All the best to Poland. And keep on doing the work. And I'm very excited, especially what's to come musically. Thanks a lot, Thomas. That was amazing. Thanks for being our guest on the Telekom Electronic Beats podcast.
Thank you for this opportunity. Thank you very much.
So this was Thomas Wierski, one part of the founding team of the fashion brand and music label Misbehave. An amazing story that proves not everything has to be mainstream to be successful. If you have any comments, let us know. Via Instagram, for example. I wish you a happy week, a happy weekend, whatever is coming up for you. Stay healthy. I am Gesine Kühne, and I'll see you at the club in their outdoor areas. Das war der Telekom Electronic Beats Podcast.
Abonniert den Podcast bei Apple, SoundCloud, Spotify oder Deezer.
Wir sehen uns im Club.
Bis dann.